I think there's an ending point to each protocol where you just call it a day, and then you have the L2s or whatever, just, you know, build whatever they want and continue building the network effects. There is nothing to reinvest into if it's a true protocol. The things I like about crypto are, like, you know, ETH is like, look, there's a base burn, there's a fee that I get, I stake my yield, I earn, you know, 3-3.5%, whatever it is. That's a very streamlined form of capitalism versus most companies in the S&P, which don't pay out a dividend.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to the Wormhole Foundation. If you are a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That's why we are super pumped to have partnered with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole Protocol. The Wormhole Protocol connects over 30 blockchains and 6 different runtimes, including Solana, Sui, Ethereum, Layer 2s, and more. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. You can claim that by just going down into the show notes and clicking on the link. All right, guys, on with the show. Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, if you are a listener of Bell Curve, you know that MEV is a massive problem, which is why we are so pumped to partner up with Flood on this season. Flood is the only gasless and MEV-free aggregator that not only gets you the best execution, but also gives you back all the extra surplus that you create every single time you swap. Now, this is relevant for both swappers and developers, but you're going to be hearing all about them later in the program. So for now, thank you, Flood, and back to the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience in crypto, period, bar none. One thing I want to call out is the Uniswap extension. So say goodbye to these days of these annoying sort of pop-up wallet extensions. You lose your place trading, you have to open it back up. Uniswap now has a nice, sleek sidebar that persists no matter where you are on the web. It's much easier to use. If you click the link at the bottom of this episode, you can join the waiting list. And I'll see what I can do to get you moved up that waiting list. But definitely go click the link, check it out.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views, and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another Bell Curve Roundup. You got me and Vance this week. Me and Vance holding down the fort. What's up, buddy? How are you?
What's going on? How are we doing? Nice.
We're doing good. We're doing good, man. We just did a, I was just telling you off the air, but we just did a little Blockworks analytics on site in New York. So our a small but mighty analytics team feeling fired up here. We got big plans for 2024 and 2025. And you're in Miami this week?
I'm Miami.
Do the Miami teams.
Little birthday thing for a friend. And yeah, Michael's about to join me. So let's get it going.
Oh boy. You guys got to come back next week with some stories. We're expecting big
No, we've gotten tamers. We've gotten older.
Yeah. Well, there's a rumor that you guys have a boat. Did I ever tell you my boat story with Yano's bachelor party? In dude, honestly, this was the worst money I've ever spent on anything in my life. It was the third day of his bachelor party down in, I think it was Cabo, and they rented this like crazy boat. And this was originally when there were 15 guys, so we were going to spread the cost around all of them. But 8 people bailed on the last day, so immediately goes down. Like, all right. And then there were hurricanes before, so it was safe, but there were a bunch of waves. And within going on there immediately, Yano and I got seasick and just tried not to puke for like 4 hours. It was like $2,000. $2,000 a pop. Worst money ever spent. So I'm wishing you better vibe for this week.
Last time I was here, I caught a shark fishing. So let's see.
Like bare hands? You just dove in and wrapped your arm around at that point?
I was reeling it in. It was a big fighting fish, you know?
Nice. Nice. Very good. Well, speaking of reeling in, before we get into the actual stories of the week, we got to pour one out for our friends that are in Dubai right now, who are also potentially wrangling sharks, except it's in the streets. So I didn't realize that you could actually, this is sort of a cool thing about Dubai and just desert countries in general, but they actually create fake rain. So they inject something up into the clouds and it actually creates rain, but I guess it's not a super exact science. It looks like they just flooded the entire city, and they've got token 2049 going out there right now. So yeah, hearts out for the folks who made it out to Dubai and like waiting around the show floor. But tough
look. This is a crypto conference classic. 2020 KBW, it was like torrential street flooding rain as well. So, you know, all part of the process, I guess. But yeah, good luck out there.
Dude, it's just an event organizer's nightmare. Like, my heart goes out. I don't even know what the reaction on our team would be if that was us too. So yeah, Token 2049 organizers, I'm sorry, man. That's just a rough go. But
tough one. Tough bid.
Tough bid. But moving on to real stories this week. So I feel like the last couple weeks we've seen a pretty, I'll use the word standard, but I'd love to get your take, correction in markets. So as we're recording this, I think Bitcoin is trading right around 60K. Maybe it's back. Oh, it's back up to 64. All right. That's a nice little rebound. But we kissed 60K down from 74. And this retracement has now been going on for the last month or so. And definitely Bitcoin is fine, but alts have definitely taken a bath. And some of the frothier sections of the AI coin sort of bags, like Deepin bags, some of the alt L1s, they've just gotten absolutely smoked. I think Solana went down to 130 or something like that from over 200. So what's your prognosis for, why correction, and where do we go from here, do you think?
So it's first thing I would say, it's not just a crypto correction, it's general markets. And the S&P is catching a bounce today, but I think it's been down for the past 4 days, which is pretty rare. And so I think there's two narratives that are happening right now globally. One, which is interest rate cuts are not coming, which I personally think is a fade. Michael disagrees with that. He thinks there's no cuts on the horizon, but I think the economy is probably weaker than expected, and you probably still get one. And no matter what you get, it's kind of like an acknowledgement of the process starting versus the market kind of tends to price in all the rate cuts at once, just it does on the rate hikes also. It immediately prices whatever the terminal rate thinks they think it should be, at least. So I think that's going on, definitely. And inflation is higher than people expect. The other thing that I pay, honestly, closer attention to, because I think it's bigger than interest rates, it's just, politics and the polls. And the narrative there has been basically that the race was tightening. I think there's probably some truth to that. But if you look at the battleground states, Trump's winning 6 out of 7. He's up by 3 in Michigan and Wisconsin. And it's hard to understand the election in the abstract, especially when you look at things like the popular vote. But if you look at the battleground states, and the way the battleground states work is basically Trump needs to pick up one of either Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, or Minnesota, frankly. And so, if he's leading in, three out of four of those, I kind of think the case for him not to win is pretty weak, and the market will start repricing his winning odds higher, which will kind of drive everything higher in an election year. That's kind of what I think is going on. I think there's definitely some aspect of ETH and Bitcoin taking a breather, which is healthy. There's 11-20% corrections in the last run. But then I think the alts have just really gotten crushed. Most of all, you're saying, the AI coins and things like that. And I think that's just because, people who start meme coins or VCs who fund coins, they're very good at replicating things that are working in the market and, meeting demand with that supply. And I think on that front, this is kind of the first leveling that will take us to a different, probably, paradigm for alts where, fundamentals aren't easily replicable. New categories and platforms aren't either. And so kind of just more of a move to, even if it's meme coins, we get one or we get two meme coins. We don't get 1,000. And same with, DeFi, and same with games, and same with, infrastructure. And some of these things just reach such crazy FTVs. WorldCoin was 114 billion at the top.
Yeah.
But the emissions of that, just to put it in perspective, are the size of Maker over the next year. So if you really think about it like that, I think you kind of know where the market is going to go, but also, there's there's a pretty good case for this is probably just a garden variety correction.
Yeah, this is one of these classic charts that just gets trotted out every now and again. But Chris Berninski tweeted this with the caption, in case the lettuce hands need a reminder, this is the class, just looking at the 2011, 2015, 2018, you know, 2020 cycle, and then charting where we are today. And this is I guess, trough to peak, basically. And yeah, I mean, if you look, there's obviously no guarantee that the current trend is going to play out like it has in the past. But, you know, past performance is not indicative of future results, et cetera. But this is pretty typical price action. And I do feel like we ran up really, really hot leading into the Bitcoin ETFs, which ended up being a massive catalyst, as many thought they would be. I think maybe a bit of this story is also on Bitcoin ETF flows. So we've seen relatively consistent outflows for the last week or so. You know, nothing crazy, but something in the realm of about $100 million per day, something like that. So yeah, I think, and look, I mean, to your point about it being a broader macro correction, like the S&P has been on a tear so far this year, right? Like nothing goes up forever in a straight line, and it's actually pretty healthy for there to be shakeouts like this, and it's nothing that shouldn't be expected, right? So like the more you shake this kind of stuff out, maybe the more legs there are long term in the rally.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically the chart. And like I went to a dinner where people were talking about kind of what you described, like what happens when the ETFs work in reverse, where there's outflows. And that's kind of like this existential fear that I think a lot of people have. And like rarely do markets let you get away with like not addressing whatever the existential fear is. And like, I think there's going to be probably a couple of weeks of outflows. But, you know, at the same time, the fact that Binance sold $1 billion of BTC, I think over the past 24 hours, along with the outflows, and we still didn't, you know, really meaningfully breach 60 or, you know, 60K or whatever it is. It just kind of shows you how resilient the market is. You know, like I think of it also in kind of the converse way. Like, do you think the Bitcoin ETH story is over? Probably not. You know, like there's just a lot more to play out. Like the ecosystems are developing, the ETFs are getting approved, there's really use cases. So honestly, we're not really too concerned. I think this is a pretty garden variety correction, but like I do really think, you know, a general rule of thumb is it's hard for alts to breach 100 billion. If you're like an L1, you know, an alt L1, like a bunch of them got kind of roughly there last cycle. And if you're kind of like middleware, it's hard for you to reach 20 billion. Just like the financial gravity of what the market is willing to price is tough at that level. And so, you know, I think this is just like a more meta point of like, you know, if you're thinking about doing a TGE and like, you know, the float is such that the coin will spike to 20 billion, you know, 6 months after launch, like you're not doing yourself any favors over the long term. Because that's just is frankly selling pressure before the project is really ready for prime time.
So here's another thing that's coming up is we've talked a little bit about this, but we're also like just a couple of days out actually from the halving. And the halving is traditionally this sort of fulcrum point that these four-year cycles have swung around. And I know CoinDesk put out something recently just looking at what the price action looked like around the, you know, before and after the first, second, and third halving. So that was in 2012, 2016, and 2020. So just the halving, I'm sure folks listening would be familiar, but that's just when the block reward for Bitcoin gets cut in half. And I think it's at 6.125 or something like that right now. And it's going to get cut to 3 something. And, you know, you can see that it's not, I mean, mostly the price appreciation actually tends to happen post-halving, you know, around, 6 to 9 months or something like that. And I think the story of this entire cycle so far is maybe it feels a little bit like an abnormal cycle in a couple of ways, but it's really just, it actually is exactly how past cycles have played out, just with a couple of changes. So I think, again, one of the things that just really stumped people is Solana just outperforming pretty aggressively very early in the cycle. Usually what happens is Bitcoin runs first, then ETH runs second, and then kind of like blue chips and then meme coins. And what happened this cycle is Solana ran really hard, really fast. And that was just because I think there was a crazy dislocation post the FTX blow up. And so it made everyone say, hey, is something weird happening here? Is ETH like lagging? And I just think it was a idiosyncratic Solana thing. And then the other thing that was different this time was that we got the Bitcoin ETFs, and maybe that pulled forward some of the growth or some of the price appreciation a little bit sooner relative to the halving than it would typically happen. But overall, I think this is, you know, pretty standard cycle stuff here. There is a debate that's currently happening about how impactful the halving really is. Is it more psychological than mechanical? Like
we have the, we have this debate every single time.
I know.
Empirically, just even if you look at, like, you know, these charts, it's not priced in.
Yeah.
If it is the placebo, it doesn't matter. The placebo affects the psychology, affects the bidding behavior, except, like, you know, it's all tied together. It's never, you know, one for one. You can't really measure it at all. So that's my thoughts, at least.
Vance, where do you sit on this argument that one of the things that also might be different this time, and people have argued this in the past as well, is that, well, these flows that are coming in via Bitcoin are coming into an ETF now. They're not, you know, typically what happens is people buy Bitcoin first, the price appreciates, you take some of your chips and you roll it into ETH and alts and whatever. And now it's going to be a little bit different because, well, people are buying it in these vehicles that exist in TradFi and your brokerage account. It's not as easy to just take that and roll it into, you know, shitcoin XYZ. Are you a subscriber to that thought, or do you think that's not a super meaningful distinction ultimately?
There's probably some truth to that. I mean, Where's Bitcoin dominance right now?
I can pull it up. Let's
see. Yeah, I mean, you kind of have this like cliff, you know, at the end of the last bear market into this trough, then it goes back up, usually tops at like 71%. We're at 55% right now. Here, I'll just throw this chart up.
Cool.
Or if you could throw it up. We're at 55.7% right now. The last cycle top was 71%. So, it's more a function of, like, it's like, I wouldn't think of it as like one person in their brokerage account, you know, buying Bitcoin, it going up, and then bidding these other coins. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. Maybe it'll be ETH when it has an ETF, but it's more so like the aggregate wealth effect of the ecosystem, because like, we're still at a point in crypto's history where we hold, you know, the crypto natives hold most of these coins. And so, you know, we all get wealthy, and then it also becomes a function of pricing. You know, I guess Bitcoin was a little bit higher, like 69K at the top of last cycle. You know, you're looking at like ETH at 4K at that point, and you're like, can this triple from here if Bitcoin goes up 1.5x or goes to 100K? So it's also about relative value and kind of how the crypto natives participate in that, and also front run whatever, you know, the ETF situation is going forward, which, you know, I think all of us are believers that if not in May, it's happening probably in the next year, maybe sooner, you know, maybe at the end of that year, but like the market can kind of look through that.
So I agree with you. I think even if you look at what's happening right now, you've seen this talked about, the Bitcoin meme coin barbell, where Bitcoin is doing well and meme coins and everything in the middle is kind of struggling a little bit. And I think the reason for that is not because there's a bunch of crypto natives that are holding Bitcoin and then rotating those gains into meme coins. I think it's because crypto natives know how they've seen this movie before and they know how the sequence plays out, and they're just trying to skip to the end. So they know it goes Bitcoin, ETH, blue chip, DeFi, whatever, alt L1s, meme coin, then it ends on meme coins. And they're just like, yep, I've seen this. I know when Bitcoin goes up, eventually it's going to go to meme coins. So I'm just going to skip right to the end and go into meme coins. So again, I think it's maybe less about mechanically about wealth creation and more just pattern recognition, in the same way that, yeah, the halving could be a little bit of a placebo, but at the end of the day, that's still a really important effect, right? It's still going to have a huge impact on the price. So
yep. It's also about like total size, like at what's Bitcoin at right now? At 1.25 trillion. That's a big asset. Like your scale becomes obviously, like, as your price goes up, your market cap expands, it gets harder to move the price. Like, you're probably even at a price right now where you need probably like $20 to $50 million of inflows per day to like maintain it on the ETF side, to like maintain it at this price.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're going to need to see those ETF inflows get back to like the hundreds of millions per day, like, or maybe even billions, like when it's like super, you know, frothy and bullish. But like, I think these things are going to be taking a breather for, you know, until kind of the narrative on interest rates or the narrative on, you know, the presidential race tightening goes away. But, you know, that could be a month, it could be a few months, but, you know, I think the longer term is what's more important to play for. And like, you know, both, you know, interested in Democratic politics and Republican politics, but I think one side, if that administration changes, and I think that the betting odds are certainly favoring Trump at the moment, like, that expands the industry like 100x. And so I think it's even worth like the temporary economic malaise if you see that play out, to potentially get to that endpoint.
So the other thing that I've always thought is that the price actually leads the narrative, not the other way around. If price ends up moving up, people look for reasons for why the price is up. And now the price is down a little bit and people are looking for reasons why. And they're, oh, it's the election fears, or, oh, it's the interest rate stuff. And honestly, it's not a great podcast sounding explanation, but maybe it's just that crypto and equities have ripped so far this year. There's naturally going to be, everyone got long, and then that's how these sort of counter trends happen. And this was what was always going to happen here. And now we're all looking for some explanation. But I feel like most of the stuff that we've been talking about so far this year hasn't really ultimately changed. Like, it's still a super bullish environment for crypto. I'm not even sure the interest rates really matter that much right now. I'm not sure that's what's moving markets. On the macro side, it really feels like the deficit is much more important and the election is much more important this year. I think interest rates, they're always super important, obviously, but it's kind of last year's story. And I'm just not sure 3 cuts versus 6 cuts and is it July versus August is really what's moving the needle at the current moment, you know?
Yeah. I think for the most part, like, when we were buying in 2022, it was like, you know, ETH probably 1 to 2K this year, maybe 2 to 3K the next year, maybe, you know, like, you kind of like, that was like my simplistic framework, and, you know, use that to keep myself honest in terms of, you know, if it's looking like a bearish day, or are we still kind of within the long-term plan? I think so. But I mean, the macro and the politics, I think those are kind of like the ex post facto rationale for whatever happens with price. But, you know, sentiment can flip on a dime. People don't even remember when they're bullish or when they were last bullish. Like, people can't even tell you what they were buying or what they were thinking about. And so, like, the market literally has the shortest memory of any person that you know. And it's kind of like, that's like where Mr. Market comes from. It's just like your irrational friend who's kind of bipolar and, you know, stampedes either direction. And it's just not worth really worrying about the near term. And if you're not playing to the long term, like, you're probably playing the wrong game.
Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to the title sponsor of this season of Bell Curve, the Wormhole Foundation. Now, if you are an on-chain user, which I bet you are, if you're listening to Bell Curve, you know that the cross-chain experience in crypto still sucks. Let's just call a spade. We talk about it on this program all the time. Interop is still a big problem, which is why we specifically wanted to team up with the Wormhole Foundation. They are a decentralized interop platform that powers multi-chain applications and bridges. So that could be anything from DeFi to NFTs, governance, oracles, and more. So if you are a developer and you're building cross-chain assets, apps, or data or anything like that, I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of this episode and go check out to see what you can build on Wormhole. And Wormhole, first of all, this is a fun team. They did something really cool with us. You can actually go and click the link at the bottom of the screen, which is going to send you to a landing page where you can claim your own unique Wormhole NFT. So we're doing this with me and we're doing this with Jason, my co-founder. So help a brother out. It's a super cool NFT. I promise. Go click the link at the bottom of this episode and fill out your POAP, get your free NFT. And if you're a dev, head over to Wormhole and check out to see what cool cross-chain stuff you can build. Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, Flood is the perfect partner for this episode on the multi-chain future because Flood is solving so many of the issues that we're going to be talking about this season. And this is relevant for both traders and devs. So if you are a trader, you should definitely head over to FloodSwap and start trading because they solve three massive problems. One, gasless trading. No more pesky trading fees. Two, you don't have to worry about getting front run. MEV free. And then three, they have excellent order routing so that you know that you are getting the best price. So head over to FloodSwap and click the link in the bottom of the show notes. We're going to send you right there. For the devs out there, you can leverage Flood's flexible hooks, allowing you to make swapping a first-class primitive by adding custom order types like TWAPs. Or if you're a wallet builder or something like that, you can actually build your own order flow auction in and start recapturing a bunch of that MEV. If you want to reach out to them, go to devs@flood.bid or just jump right in the Discord. All right, guys. Thanks very much. Appreciate you, Flood. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none, in all of crypto. Here's how I would divide the protocol today. There's a web part, a mobile part, and an extension part. You can say goodbye to the pop-up wallet extension. It's just not great from a UX perspective. Now what they've delivered is this nice, clean sidebar where you can just very easily track swaps, sign transactions, send or receive crypto anywhere. Just a huge UX improvement. On the web part of it, huge improvements here. You can buy and sell 700 plus tokens at your price, on your terms, and they've got limit orders, which are powered by Uniswap X, and there's gasless. They've also got real-time charts, transaction logs, pool data, project information, all this cool stuff that just really improves your UX trading on the web. And again, all of this is powered by the smartest protocol in terms of Uniswap or Uniswap X. Click the link at the bottom. Uniswap extension is in alpha right now, and we'll see what we can do about getting you moved up that list. Thank you very much, Uniswap.
Changing tack a little bit here to talk about something else that's happening on Bitcoin. We are going to see the launch of Runes this week. So this is another Casey Rotemore, who is the creator of Ordinals. This is another one of his projects, but he's launching Runes on the day of the halving, which it looks like it's going to be in a couple of days. So basically what Runes allow you to do is to create some sort of token standard equivalent to sort of like a competitor to BRC20s, which is kind of a poorer form of ERC20s that exist on Ethereum on Bitcoin. And it's not exactly inscriptions, but it's close enough to inscriptions that, you know, that's good enough, you know, for you to really understand. Bitcoin has a different model than Ethereum does, which has Bitcoin is just UTXOs and you can't use smart contracts on it. So it's extremely limited in terms of what you can actually do. So huge credit to Casey here for what he's done with Ordinals, and Runes are just kind of the latest version of that. But it's just basically a very crude way to get around the limitations of the Bitcoin blockchain and do Ethereum-like things. And people are really excited about Runes. And frankly, it's driving an enormous amount of activity on the Bitcoin blockchain today. So Bitcoin inscription NFTs are, even generally within the global world of NFTs, are now 55% of NFT trades. And you got to give credit to Magic Eden, who they started on Solana, and they sort of pivoted over to Bitcoin, and they really capitalize on the Ordinals fad and I'm sure they're going to do extremely well on Runes, et cetera. And it's actually led to a resurgence in their market share on Solana also. So yeah, I'm not really sure what your thoughts are. Our data guy over here, Dan Titsmith, absolutely hates the idea of inscriptions, basically just views it as spam and completely silly, pretty meritless. But what are your general thoughts on this? I'm not sure how deep you've got into Runes.
I would say this is another example of price driving, narrative driving use case.
Yeah.
You know, it's like great that Bitcoin's going up. This like incentivizes all this new developer activity. Some people on my team are super, you know, optimistic on what these could be. I kind of like, I don't know. It's like, is this more like an NFT or is it more like a meme coin? Like, which side of that framework are we on? Are we like digging for like artifacts that are lost in like the chain, or is it like pure financial nihilism, or is this in the middle of the curve? Like, that's kind of where I go.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, how would you how would you define the difference between NFTs and meme coins in general? Is the whole Kobe thing? Is it just all
just the liquidity? Yeah. The liquidity. Yeah. NFTs are such an inefficient form of speculating because you got to find one guy to buy your whole, like, you know, even if it's a, you know, one of many, like, you got to find a very specific buyer for that. You can't price it on an AMM. You can't like sell it or buy it indiscriminately. So, you know, like, I think that's the difference, honestly. And I mean, maybe I'm just a boomer, but like, you know, the runes are cool. I think it's an interesting experiment, but what's the long-term longevity? Are these like CryptoPunks? Or is this like an ephemeral financial nihilism meme coin that goes up and down? I don't know either.
Honestly, I think probably the dynamic is the same dynamic that drives an enormous amount of speculation on crypto, which is wealth gets created in L1 coin or token. So BTC, ETH, SOL, and people look to speculate on that. And they look to turn those gains into other things and get more exposure. And there's just an extremely limited universe of assets out there. I mean, this is probably the rabbit hole that many crypto natives end up going down, where, you know, remember when you were getting into the space and it felt like Bitcoin and ETH were super risky, but then once you've been in the ecosystem for a couple of years, you're like, I need to be taking some more risk than this. Like, this stuff's obviously going up, right? This feels too safe. And so the universe of stuff is just pretty limited when you're looking at it through that lens, when Bitcoin or ETH are your safety bags. And so that's how you end up going into the stuff that sort of kind of might work, and maybe there's a future there. And I mean, there have also been tons of stuff like that ended up working over the years. Like, you guys were super early into, you know, Chainlink and Aave, and how crazy did that seem at the time? I remember looking at that stuff and being like, it feels a little too risky for me at the time.
You got to be in that headspace to get that type of return where you're going on these rabbit hole adventures. Like, that's what makes a market, you know, people who are early, and, you know, then they bring in people and then it becomes popular. So I'm glad people are doing this. It's cool to see the Bitcoin ecosystem developing. I've said this on a couple of sorry, just checking if my mic was working. I've said this on a couple of different tweets, but like, it's pretty notable that the ETH and Bitcoin ecosystems are converging on the same model. It's like, I mean, one is proof of work, one is proof of stake, obviously, but it's like the L1 is for the sticky DeFi, the NFTs, the grails, you know, the high value transactions. And then the L2s are for, you know, speculating meme coins, runes, inscriptions, like, you know, whatever. And I think as they become closer and like people recognize that, they're going to compare them on more dimensions, specifically like moneyness, fees, revenue. Like, I think that this is where a lot of crypto goes. It's like, if you think about the end game of different protocols, you know, I think like this web of L2s is one end game in kind of a different way. Like, restaking is like a different end game. I see that as kind of like, and that's both on Bitcoin and ETH. Restaking to me is kind of like M&A in crypto. You're basically saying like, come under my wing, you know, give tokens away to my community. Like, we'll develop primitives. And so, like, you know, you're aggregating all these services. And I think, like, you know, Maker is another good form of endgame. And like, their roadmap is literally entitled endgame. But it's like, you know, they're becoming this, like, kind of superstructure with all these sub-DAOs. And they're allocating, you know, DAI to the basis trade and to crypto loans and to RWAs. And, like, that's kind of like an endgame of DeFi. Like, I think generally, like, a lot of these endgames are starting to play out. There's obviously still huge incentives, like multi-billion-dollar market cap, to be around standalone project. But I think kind of what we're seeing is like an aggregation of the ecosystems into this kind of like universal, either like restaking or L2 model.
I agree with that. And another ecosystem that I would point to that actually looks very similar in terms of the architecture. It is going the same way. It is kind of a neat mix in between Bitcoin and different versions of Bitcoin, and ETH is Celestia. I would put in that exact same camp, because Celestia also has this... Actually, Celestia is, in a lot of ways, what the big block vision for Bitcoin could have been if some of the tech had existed at the time, and they were able to obviate some of the negative trade-offs. So they have super big blocks. They've got a few chunky validators, or like 100 or something like that, you know, chunky validators. But then they have this thing called data availability sampling and light nodes, which basically negates all of the negative transactions that the small blocker camp used to levy at the big blocker camp. And what you're left with is this chain with very kind of dumb, sort of non-functional, but extremely large blocks. And that's kind of similar to Bitcoin, which is pretty, you know, it's UTXO model. You can't do things like smart contracts on it, but it's kind of small blocks. And, you know, each one of those things, there's an incentive to create rollups on top of that. And in Celestia, it's more for smart contract functionality. And for Bitcoin, it's more like, well, it's kind of like block space and functionality. And then Ethereum, it's just block space. So yeah, like I think over time, especially the Celestia, Bitcoin, and Ethereum, it's all converging on the same stuff. Probably even over time, Solana ends up looking like that too. So, and I think what that means on a long time horizon is, I think these things are, what that really means on a long time horizon is that these things end up getting commoditized. And right now there are these religious communities around, you know, Bitcoin versus Solana versus ETH, and it's so different. But I think at the end of the day,
I think that's the only non-commoditizable piece of it.
Yeah.
Like the network effects. Think about Tether. Like, I would argue Tether is dominant because it's dominant. It's like, it's kind of circular, but like there's, like when you have money, like there's huge network effects to that. And so like, I kind of think about it architecturally is one way, but the other way is like, how do the network effects accrue? What are they powered by? For ETH, I would say it's the asset. For Bitcoin, I would say it's the same. For Maker, and I would say it's the DAI stablecoin. It's like, you know, if you, we've done some analysis, it looks like DAI captures around 35-40% of all DeFi profits. Just because, you know, like if you think about Athena too, it's like, okay, this means Maker can now get into trading without taking any risk because it's delta neutral. Obviously, there's the exchange risk, all that stuff. But like, you know, that's a superstructure. ETH's a superstructure. Bitcoin's a superstructure. My question with DA layers is like, are your network effects 10 times more powerful if there's a community of people using your DA layer? Like, what's their relationship to that? To me, it kind of has to be about the underlying asset in some way. And that applies to restaking as well.
I think that too, but I guess then the question would be, if it's really about the network effects and the liquidity of the asset, then it doesn't even really matter so much what the underlying protocol is doing. Like, I'm not sure, because the Bitcoin protocol is a really interesting example of this, where, prior to Ordinals, transaction count had just been going down. There'd been very few legitimate upgrades since Taproot. And even by the standards of an EIP, like, Taproot's wasn't a crazy change or anything like that. But the asset price still kept going up. And I sort of view that's what TIA is as well. They have one of the challenges of Celestia's architecture is that you can't, because you don't have smart contract functionality and like TIA isn't a settlement layer, you can't do the types of rollups, you know, like settlement contract, very trustless bridging up from main chain ETH to rollups that you can do for Celestia. They have a solution to this, which is just ZK, like a ZK account that basically, instead of like a valid signature, there's a proof and you kind of submit like proof or a valid proof, and then you can bridge TIA up to like their sort of sovereign rollups and stuff like that. It's on the roadmap, but I view it as being all birds of a feather, pretty similar. And I've always looked at TIA as an asset in its own right, and then there's the DA sort of business model. But I think the protocol has less to do with which assets are successful than just the liquidity and adoption and narrative that form around the assets themselves. So,
you do have to have an underlying cash flow driver. Mm. Like, you know, like ETH and Bitcoin, I think this approach has a lot of credibility. Like, ETH did like $400 million in profits in Q1 or whatever it was. Bitcoin, I think, frankly, has work to do with POW, and like, it's so expensive and there's so much incentives and the fees seem to be growing. Celestia, and like we have Celestia bags, but you know, just like the revenue of the underlying DA, I don't think it has to be super high necessarily, but like you need something that gives you credibility when people are like, I'm using this as money. Because like, you know, there's a lot of different factors which impact people using this money. I would say the reason why we're optimistic on the Solana ecosystem is because we spend a lot of time with the Jito people. And you can see the use as money of Sol. Like you look at their TVL chart. I'm just going to throw it up. You look at this TVL chart, it's a hockey stick. It's gone from 48K in December 22 to 10 million Sol today.
Yeah.
So
I agree with you. There needs to be some kind of lock-in. This is the whole, you know, not to go all macro and talking about money on this podcast, but yeah, this is the, I mean, the way that sovereigns have historically done this is you have to pay taxes in this currency, and that's the lock-in, and that creates the network effect. And it's kind of the same thing in blockchains, right? You know, in order to get access to this block space, you have to pay in our unit of currency. And that's actually why when the burn was originally theorized as a mechanism, they were trying to get around this thing that they called economic abstraction at the time, which was people basically off-chain contracts between a validator and someone who was trying to pay fees, right? It's like, well, I don't want to actually pay you, you know, 100 ETH or whatever it is. Like, I want to pay you 50. I'm just going to pay you $50 off-chain. You can just waive my fee. So by then, you're essentially circumventing the tax lock-in. So that's why the burn initially got created. But yeah, the Jito chart is, I love the Jito. Lucas was just on the pod a couple weeks ago. He and Eugene are my standing Solana MEV guys, but
like I think, you know, I didn't even know what we were talking about at first. This is a good conversation, but I think like generally this is how people should think about the long term. Like, what does this look like in 10 years? There's money-based ecosystems that have network effects via their native assets. And then I think the maker bet thesis is that maybe that native asset should be a stablecoin that can internalize all the profits on all these DeFi and, you know, frankly, CeFi now activities and redirect it to holders of a stablecoin. And like that is like a very different vision. And maybe there are other visions. Like you could think about, like, if Uniswap releases its own chain, it started with the AMM primitive, generated a ton of profits, maybe gotten people to use Uni as money. I don't even really see people using Uni as money, though.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if that's a thing, but like they'll launch a chain. Maybe you back into it, same way the Maker did, where it's like you start with a stablecoin, then you launch a blockchain. So yeah, you should think about the use cases from the ground up in terms of like their initial profit generating enterprise. And then what they do after that is like, you know, they're either creating their own form of money via allowing people to use it, or it's frankly more like a SaaS business where they're just like a protocol that sits on top of every other chain and, you know, tries to externalize whatever they do.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. So this is something I've been thinking about recently too. So part of the lock-in that these ecosystems that are built around a base unit of currency as a money have is the social layer. And a really clear narrative, and this is what I've thought Bitcoin has kind of nailed from day one, is, well, not since day one, they had the block size war, but they're like, we are a store of value, digital gold type thing. Really clear at, you know, 21 million hard cap, super easy to understand.
That's changed, though. The narratives have changed over time.
True. But recently that's what it's been. And there's an accompanying vibe to that. It's kind of like a macro Austrian economic, gold loving, you know, keep the government out of my property sort of vibe. And that works with their whole thing. So with now that they have most of the transactions on the base chain coming from, well, like now the fact that there is a base chain and there are gonna be L2s and there are runes and there are NFTs, suddenly you've got people that are coming back and saying, hey, Bitcoin should be innovating. We should be pushing the envelope. And this is the tech people versus money people tension that has always existed in crypto a little bit. And do you think it's disrupting this kind of neat narrative and shelling point to build the community around? Do you think it's a positive thing? Or what do you think about that? Because I think there's a lot of pretty spirited conversation that's happening right now in the Bitcoin community.
I mean, I don't even know the extent to which they're still infighting around like expansion of Bitcoin being bad, but it will change the narrative. because narratives are usually set by like people on the margins. And at first it's a whisper, and then it's like them shouting with a megaphone at you. And then it's everyone saying it. And so like where this all naturally leads is, do we have enough fees for the 21 million supply cap to be real? And so like, you know, at some point they'll have that fight, but it's going to be like 100 years until that really matters. But like, you know, I think at a certain point that will stare you in the face. Maybe they'll talk about premium steak. Who knows? It's kind of unclear who the like core devs are to me or what their values are other than like stopping more progress on these apps. But it will look more like ETH. And I think ETH will also look more like Bitcoin, you know, as it moves towards this, like, you know, fees are, or, you know, whatever. I think Nick Schleck from Ribbit did a presentation on ETH. He said like the fees were like, you know, revenue is like $6 billion a year or something like that. You know, there's like just enough deflation where it's like not too deflationary, but like it's not rising in supply. Like, I feel like everyone is just going to go, like, this is the end game for all this stuff, is that the branding and network effects of the assets are all that really matter. And I think if you read like Maker's endgame plan with this in mind, it feels very clear headed in terms of like really nailing where this is all going. And, you know, 99% of protocols will probably die. We've also launched a shit ton of protocols, totally, and meme coins and all this stuff. But like the point is, you get to those 10, you know, there's the Mag 7 is 7 stocks. It's not 50, it's not 100, it's 7. And they accrue probably 80% of the profits of tech. So like, you think about the stuff over the long term, what do you want to invest in? Whatever the FANG or Mag 7 or what QQQ is going to be of this industry. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of it, you know, especially when you look at like WorldCoin and, you know, all the emissions and like all the other tokens that are going to have emissions, like you need to have something that's strong enough to basically stand against those emissions, but also like well-placed enough to really navigate the strategic landscape of crypto, which is merging, I would say. Maybe not collapsing, but it's like, I feel like we're going like this.
It's merging.
Like, there's a lot of protocols launching, but like we're going like this.
So it is merging. And here's an example that I would give you. So we're doing the third permissionless that we've done. And I don't think we've talked about Bitcoin at all in any of the previous conferences, because really it's kind of a conference for people that are building on the frontier for the most part. And but this year, one of the big themes, we're like, yeah, honestly, where a lot of the innovation is happening, or where a lot of the mind share is right now in like the builder crypto native community is Bitcoin. And so we have like a whole theme, like Bitcoin Renaissance, and Casey Rotemore is going to be there, and Muneeb from Stacks, like a bunch of the Bitcoin L2s. That's never been a thing before. And yeah, we've never even been like, yeah, this maybe makes sense. It's always been kind of DAS is Bitcoin and permissionless is kind of ETH, Solana, Cosmos. And yeah, it's starting to merge. And I do think it's an interesting, I think Ethereum's kind of going through a transition from the other side, which is Ethereum counterpositioned against Bitcoin really nicely back in the day, where, you know, if you didn't want to be like a doomer and just like sit there and stack sats and, you know, not do anything or take risks or innovate, then there was this void, and Ethereum was like, hey, we're a general smart contracting platform, come build apps, you know, we're very optimistic. And that was the Ethereum vibe. And now that Ethereum's kind of growing up and being like, well, now that we're a $300 billion protocol, you know, and we really see ourselves as a money, then you don't really want the people that are managing your money to be like, oh, optimistic dreamer, right? You need to be a little bit more serious, right? Like if you have that much wealth that's being held or secured by these developers, then you want to make sure that they're like serious conservative people. And so Ethereum is almost coming the other way a little bit, being like, okay, we're grown up now. We care about things like yields and this is a money. And so I almost see Bitcoin and Ethereum kind of coming closer together than they've been in a long point. So to your point on convergence.
I think the long-term question, which we'll have to answer in the short term, because like you can't have these things have no fundamentals forever, is like, we've talked about this before, but how do you create the best internet money? What should it be based off of? What's the best economic architecture versus like the most scalable? Like, is it better to have, you know, high value users doing enough transactions on your main chain where you can burn enough of the supply for it to be stable? Or is it better to charge everyone nothing and, you know, basically drive fees to zero and make a play for the most users? And I think like this L1, L2 architecture is admitting basically that you need the L1 transactions at a relatively high cost with a relatively small amount of users who do relatively few transactions per year. But then you want to make a play for everyone using your asset and being native to these chains with these L2s. And like, you know, I mean, one way to think about it is, do you think you can be a $1 trillion protocol as a monolithic chain? I would argue you need like a lot of different incentive camps rowing in your direction. Like, you know, how much did the OP, you know, retroactive grants do for the ETH community? A ton. Like, you know, ARB, same deal. Like all these, you know, airdrops, like those only happen if you have like this plurality of L2s approach. So,
yeah.
You know, maybe the ceiling for alt L1s is like 100 billion. Well, that wouldn't surprise me. But maybe to get to a trillion plus, you either need to be like the first mover or you need to have this like L2, you know, based ecosystem where everyone's burning a little bit and you still got your L1 fees and, you know, the economics flow upwards.
Yeah, I think, well, maybe it's relevant then that Solana has been struggling. The UX of Solana has been extremely challenged in the last, I don't know, a couple weeks, at least a month since meme coins started to take off. And to your point, Solana is the chain that has the most transactions right now. It's something like 35 million transactions per day, which is a pretty mind-blowing statistic. Now, how many of those people are is it just repeated kind of gamblers like clicking like this on you know, whatever? But still, usage is usage. And I do think it's, on the one hand, it's bullish to have so much demand on your chain that you break down. But on the other hand, this is a huge problem for Solana. And I think they need a little something more than just, I know they're working on a patch right now, 1.18, and hopefully that's going to be live and they're going to fix some of these problems. But I still haven't really seen, at least from my perspective, a long-term roadmap or strategy towards solving this. Because even if they implement this successful patch, then they're just going to, there's just, you know, what if, okay, they fix that and then it goes up to 60 million transactions per day, right? And at some point, you kind of have to either start charging more. And I heard Keone from Monad make the statement that he thought Solana transactions were just too high based on compute, because eventually you have to price those compute resources appropriately. Or yeah, maybe you end up doing something like a layered approach like L2s. I don't know what the solution is, but I think it's still it's an open question. Yeah.
So if I were to make the argument for Solana, I would say that basically the so if you think about Bitcoin and ETH, the people who own Bitcoin and ETH and use Bitcoin and ETH on the L1s, like they're going to use it there forever. Like, you know, maybe we'll grow that pie by, you know, 10x over the next 4 years or whatever. But like, you know, those are sticky L1 transactions that are not moving. It'll bootstrap the chain. What the market kind of hasn't figured out or explored is like, who's going to have the most users? Who's going to have the most users, and what is that sweet spot of fees versus throughput versus use case? And, you know, if you could make the chain free and charge everyone nothing, like, would you? You probably wouldn't. You're like, that's not the optimal economic model. So there is a sweet spot. But I think that's where the market is going to be most subject to disruption, where it's like, okay, cool. You know, you launch an all L1. Let's say you have 100,000 users. Let's say like Immutable X or Ronin has like, you know, 10 million, but they're all basically very low paying users. They are monetized on, you know, the DEX versus the actual base underlying fees. Like, is there a different economic model that has less to do with like the gas cost abstraction of a blockchain and maybe more with like the DeFi underlying primitives or like, you know, gameplay or things like that for, you know, the blockchains that have like 10 million users? Because that economic model is going to be different. And honestly, probably so is the underlying asset. It probably doesn't have that same call option to become money. And so like you'll need to find kind of like a different type of valuation framework or you know, what have you. So like I think there is room for like these high throughput blockchains that charge people very little, but like you need to have that sweet spot.
So here's another thing that I've thought about that I haven't really seen discussed that much, but One thing that might end up being having a big impact here is on how performant the L1 is in terms of how good the L2 ecosystem is. So to give you an example of that, a huge huge issue on the ETH L2, roll-up roadmap has been the interop, right? And the solution to this that Justin Drake has been talking about is shared sequence or based sequencing, where the Ethereum still does the sequencing and basically just route all the transactions down there. The reason why none of the rollups were seriously considering that until you had something like pre-confirmations was it was still a 12-second block time. And that was the whole point of moving to a layer two is that you could have much shorter confirmations for users. So you just surrender basically all of the utility. But on Solana, base sequencing would be super easy because you have 400 millisecond block times. So all of a sudden, like you could do something like base sequencing on Solana tomorrow with a whole bunch of different rollups. You wouldn't have like you basically solved 90% of the interop challenge overnight because you wouldn't have to wait 3 years for, you know, restaking to get built out and pre-confirmations to get adopted and all that stuff. So I do think the functionality of the L1 actually has a huge advantage. And if Solana were to go down the L2 route, which I'm not sure if they even are going to, I think it would have some legs up over some of the like Bitcoin, like just think about the Bitcoin L2 functionality. I know nothing about it, but I just have to imagine it's so limited compared to ETH, you know? So maybe the L1 performance ends up being a big deal.
I think it does. And I think at the end of the day, the apps have the power, right?
They do. They do, dude. Absolutely.
You know, the apps and the assets, frankly. Because your assets are floating around on L1 or L2 and they're burning ETH, like that's not leaving your ecosystem. But like the apps are the key thing here. And I mean, I'm pretty encouraged by what I see in gaming right now. Like Pixels has 200,000 people in their VIP basically group, and those people have paid to be there and they're real users. And, you know, they think they've got about 1 million monthly actives at this point. And, you know, like, what does that look like when it has 10 million users? They've probably got a lot of leverage over whatever chain they're built on. And if those block space fees are valuable enough, like that's a conversation that probably has to happen. So I think crypto is going to look a lot different in like, you know, 3 or 4 years, in a good way. I think the majors are kind of the majors, but I think all of this other stuff is like subject to a lot of change. And things are just like, there's so much dispersion in pricing that like, I think that's going to drive a lot of just like interesting behavior over the next couple of years.
Yeah. All right. Here's one final question for you because it came up during this analytics on site. It always does. But how do you think about the concept of profits or fees for an L1? Because here's something that I am struggling to wrap my head around, which is when you think about profits from the perspective of a company, why it's attractive for two reasons. So one, it can get returned to you. Or two, you can compound your capital gains by reinvesting those profits into more employees, more R&D, that's going to lead to even more profits in the future. And in the case of these L1s, you know, I know we talk about base fees as being profits, and in some way it is getting returned to you, right? It's getting burned. So it's kind of getting returned to you as a holder, but you don't have that compounding effect that you do in a company, right? Like there's no organized body which is directing those profits towards compounding the advantage of Ethereum. It's almost like if it was a company, you're just immediately dividending that out, which is good. But I think the reason why equities like outperform every asset, and it's not even close over a long period of time, is that compounding effect. So do you think that's a meaningful distinction? Do you think it's not? Like, this is kind of why I view the L1s as more commodity-like than equity-like, at least on a long time frame to me.
I view them as more commodity-like as well. Like, you know, I think there's an ending point to each protocol where you just call it a day, and then you have the L2s or whatever, just, you know, build whatever they want and continue building the network effects. There is nothing to reinvest into if it's a true protocol. Like, you know, we're not going to improve X times Y equals K. Labs, Uniswap labs might release subsequent versions of that, but like that will come from a different economic arrangement. I think that's how it's intended to be. The things I like about crypto are like, you know, ETH is like, look, there's a base burn. There's a fee that I get. I stake my yield. I earn, you know, 3-3.5%, whatever it is. That's a very streamlined form of capitalism versus most companies in the S&P, which don't pay out a dividend. They just tell you, you know, trust me, bro. And they you know, invest into their own companies. And it's kind of like the government taxing you. It's like, you know, how, what's your level of confidence in them as a capital allocator? I would say most companies pretty low. And that's what I like about, you know, generally like Maker as well and smart contract based capitalism, whatever you want to call it. It's like, I have programmatic guarantees about if you make a dollar of revenue, I can see the costs, I can net out what earnings are. And if I want, I can get a chunk of it by staking SDAI or Maker. So like it's yeah, I think this is the way God intended it to be, you know, very streamlined, no middleman.
What are we looking at in terms of, I'm pulling up DeFi Llama right now, but what are we looking at in terms of Maker profitability or revenue these days?
Maker is at around 200 million earnings per year. And those are all used for the buyback at the moment. That's like net of SDAI payments. I mean, the big thing with Maker is that they've just opened this $1 billion vault on Morpho where they can lend against USDE. So like they put in DAI, people put in USDE, and there's kind of this positive carry trade where like USDE yields like, you know, I think it's like 15%. They lend it out at like 14%, and there's this like 1% yield that you can loop. And assuming that DAI and USDE stay on, you know, it's stable coin, which they do, you know, that's like a free basis trade. But as that yield spikes, it's like the revenue of Maker will go up as well. So, I mean, personally, internally, we think Maker is going to get to probably 10 to 15 billion of DAI supply at like 13 to 16% interest rates on average. Maybe if 15 is like crazy high forever, it'll be, you know, 20%. But that's a, you know, between a $1 and $2 billion earnings protocol at the end of the day. And I think that speaks to like, if you look at it on a chart next to ETH and Tron, like you would be generating more fees than Tron. And it would be second only to ETH and Bitcoin. So like that's how profitable this stuff is. And that's why I think it could be the end game of a lot of crypto, is this like weird stablecoin thing that like Rune created.
Have you seen the Maker or the Tron chart recently? Adam actually sent me this week because we were talking about the Justin Sun Hans Zimmer asking, but look at this little chart that Tron's got going on here. I mean, this is I'm not a TA guy at all, but chart. This is it's a good looking chart. This is a cup and handle type chart if I've ever seen one. So who knows? Maybe his excellency has. All right. I don't want, at risk of asking a crude question here, I would love to know the extent of Justin Sun's resources, because that man, I've heard some rumors about the amount of money that he chucks into some of these like restaking or Bitcoin L2 things. And yeah, I think his excellency is doing pretty well on the Tron dividends or back end or whatever. But yeah, I guess
this is what makes me a little bit more skeptical of Bitcoin L2s, is like the TVL dispersion is like three or four people.
It is.
and like talking to the Maker Core team, like whenever they see Justin deposit into SDAI, they're like, oh, we got to figure out a way to like get him out. Like I don't think he's this farmer that's like particularly friendly to the underlying protocol or the tokens that it issues. So, you know,
yeah,
one man's treasure.
So do you think that, so I've sort of heard this as well, it's not even for the Bitcoin L2s, but ETH L2s, some of the restaking platforms, they do this kind of roadshow abroad. And I think the reality is there's like 50 to 100 whales that kind of live out east, and they end up being the TVL that goes into a ton of these protocols. And I don't know if this is early Chinese miners. That's where I get the sense a lot of the money comes from, but yeah, I do think it's a smaller number of whale-like individuals. Because sometimes you see a protocol launch, you're like, I've never heard of this thing, and it's got a billion in TVL. Like, who is putting a billion in TVL and $1 billion worth of capital into one of these protocols? But maybe that's it.
The dev. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
It's dangerous out there.
Well, it's, you know what, it's an early stage industry. It's still very much Wild West. People were saying it was Wild West 6 years ago, at least when I got in, and it's still pretty Wild Westy. And I mean, even in the restaking ecosystem, I mean, there's a ton of money getting thrown around. There's a ton of LRTs now. A lot of them are great projects, but yeah, that also feels like a space that's like really heated up recently. And you know, you were saying before about AVSs. I mean, that's kind of the new L2, right? If you want a narrative and you want to buy into be a part of this ecosystem that's growing, there's a ton of attention around it. Like ABS feels like a good way to do that. Not that there's not really legitimate reasons to be an ABS, that there are, but I know it's a bit of a competition to be like,
you're kind of like selling part of your project to like Eigenlayer. You know, it's like that to me is like as close to token M&A as we might get. It's just like this natural aggregation of a lot of these ABSs or like lower level primitives that, like, if you think about a stablecoin or like a DEX, those can stand on their own as a business and be the foundation for something more.
Yep.
What else is there?
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe Borrowlend kind of.
Borrowlend, maybe, you know, perps, maybe. But like when one of those structures, a stablecoin, can subsume all others, assume that on a long enough time frame, it will.
Yeah.
You know? And kind of same with like the ETH asset as like the staking layer for all these AVSs. It's just like you are basically, you know, you're getting aggregated by the ABS or by the restaking platform and ETH the asset also.
I've got a question for you on the subject of standalone businesses. How would you look at these kind of like a DEX screener or a pump.fun type business that's kind of sprung up? They're selling picks and shovels to meme coin traders. And to be honest, they're probably raking it. They have very different business models. But a DEX screener, I think they charge something like $300 for a meme coin to link socials or something like that. And pump.fun is a more traditional sort of exchange model. But I mean, how would you like to look at one of those businesses, the long-term legs on it? Do you know what I mean? I'm not really sure for me.
Too early to tell. I would say that, like, you know, a good test for if something is a superstructure is like, can this happen somewhere else? You know, can like Uniswap get in this game? Can Maker get in this game? You know, there's a version of this where it's like Maker can provide, you know, the base capital for, you know, like the liquidity for meme coins, whatever. There's like a version of this where it's like Uniswap is doing this stuff instead of pump.fun. Maybe the cultural lock-in is strong enough where they can go off and spend money and, you know, acquire users and build a real moat. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, does pump.fun launch its own chain? Because like that's a real superstructure at the end of the day, and they can like kind of build more of a moat. Like I could see that very much happening. Like we're definitely, I think Haseeb said this on some podcast where it's like we're not in the kumbaya era anymore. Kind of a cynical take. I kind of agree with that in some ways, but like over the long, long term, like aggregation theory is going to play out here. And it'll be the people who have, like, for instance, I used to work at Netflix. And when I worked at Netflix, the DVD business was the cash cow. I know, sounds crazy. This was a good
time. I was an early Netflix user.
Right.
I did that. I was a customer.
And yeah. I was there when, you know, streaming was kind of getting going and we started launching our own originals. And it was like, you know, the DVD business paid for all the originals. It paid for all the streaming. It paid for the international expansion. And it allowed it to leapfrog to like a real superstructure where it was like, you know, Netflix was buying movies to put on DVDs. And then it was the entire industry. And now it dictates terms to the rest of Hollywood. And like, I think you're going to see some of that play out here. But the key is like, what are the businesses that can stand on their own? A stablecoin is one. Money-like assets that are digital is another. ETH and Bitcoin. Is it DEXs? Is it PFOF? Is it lending? Is it, you know, new meme coin paradigm? I don't know. But like, that's kind of what I think about. And our fund, we have 10-year funds. So like, that's the time scale we're on.
I think that's good. I think that's a good mental model. All right, buddy. I think unless maybe we can ask our editors here to send listeners off with the Tron... Justin's son, Hans Zimmer.
Please,
little soundtrack.
Please do.
Send you gently off into the night. You can listen. Honestly, it kind of slaps. So credit Justin's son, credit Hans Zimmer. Yeah, we can end there. But man, so
shout out,
buddy.
Later.
Peace. Cheers.
Hey everyone, Mike here. If you're a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring assets across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That is why we're incredibly excited to have teamed up with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole protocol. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. Click the link at the bottom of this episode to get your free NFT.